This is a picture of Bangkok, and this is the main river. I forget the name at the moment. It runs through Thailand, or through Bangkok. We arrived approximately the end of October. Stayed in the city for a couple of days, and then took a train north to Chiang Mai, where we spent most of the rest of our time in that country. When we arrived in Bangkok, we were arriving right at the end of the monsoon season, and this normally isn't a river or a stream of any sort. It's normally a marketplace, but there had been some torrential floods. Like a 45-minute ride from the airport to the YMCA took 4 hours because of floodwaters on the highways and that. While we were in Bangkok for a couple of days, we took a tour on this. This isn't our group, but we took a tour on this type of boat on the river, which enabled us to go by that marketplace and see that type of thing. Kind of felt like the tacky tourist there, because most of the tourists ride these kind of boats. An interesting thing happened while we were taking this tour boat through a small canal in a kind of a village section. This young boy, I could see him as we came abreast of his home, dove off the back porch of his, I guess you'd call it a shack, and swam up to the boat, and as we rode by in the boat, reached up and grabbed onto the boat and swung himself up onto the railing right next to me, and begged for some food. I didn't have any food, so I took his picture. I didn't have anything else to give him. Also, while in Bangkok, we went to the Imperial Palace, which is now a museum, a tourist-type attraction. This, when Bangkok was first became a primary civilization center, this is where the royal family lived. And it's all walled in, and it was where the royal family stayed and was protected. It's now run by the military, I guess, because there was guards and everything all over the place. This type of structure, sometimes called a jetty or a stupa, is a very common sight in Thailand and throughout some other countries in Southeast Asia. Now, the gold color, this structure is probably 75 to 100 feet high, and that is gold leaf on the whole structure. It's covered in gold leaf. That's a very common way of ornamenting a lot of their religious structures in their different temples and shrines and that type of thing. This was a vault that was within that palace area. And the legend, we were told, was that when the original Buddhist ideas that were originally in the oral tradition passed on from the Buddha, when they were first written onto some form of paper or parchment, the legend is that they are stored inside here ever since the structure was built and it's never been opened. Whether that's true is another thing, but that's what we were told. The lotus position, which this figure is in, is a common one that the Buddha used in contemplation and in meditation. You'll see a few other slides throughout the show with a Buddha figure in this position, but the facial structure and the body structure will vary greatly. And although I don't remember specifics, what that indicates, if you're a scholar and a scientist or whatever of Buddhist figures, you could look at this and just by the design and by the facial structures, etc., date this to within a 50-year span, just according to the way it's situated. We never really did learn any of the specifics about that. A lot of the religious artifacts and structures around the temples and the shrines are very, very elaborate. Again, this is gold leaf that they have on top of these, well, they're just handrails for the steps there. But there's very much, very close attention is paid to the detail of what they do. When anything that's connected religiously usually gets a lot of attention. There's no people in this picture, but the columns underneath supporting the roof in the background are probably 15 feet high, so that would give you an idea how tall this figure is. But as all good old-time palace-type things, where you can see the modern lights and the spotlights in front. Did have a chance to see that first very large stupa at night with lights shining. It was quite spectacular. I didn't have my camera at the time. Took a chance to visit a zoo. I guess this was up in Chiang Mai now. And this is a sloth bear, not native to North America that I know of. You'll notice the very long claws on his paws. It's characteristic of this type of bear. A Burmese python. Very large snake. I think this was 50 feet long or something outrageous like that. Don't want to fall into its pit, I don't think. This is a toucan. Anybody remember Toucan Sam from the Fruit Loops cereal box? Well, this is the animal that they used to come up with that figure. This is up in Chiang Mai now. About there's a group of us that tended to be a little bit adventurous, and we were only in Chiang Mai about 2 days, and we rented motorcycles, little like Honda 100s. You can rent them for about 10 bucks a day. And we rented them for the day and rode up to Chiang Rai, which is a city located very close to the Burmese border in northern Thailand. It's also all in the middle of the Golden Triangle, which is the, if you don't know what that is, it's referring to the drug trafficking that takes place in up in northern Thailand and in Burma. The hill tribe people find that growing opium is a much more stable cash crop than growing coffee or cotton or anything that is legal. So thus it's a, for us to drive up there, I guess it turns out it was kind of a big thing because you don't want to, especially young white American males, 20 to 25, don't want to be seen around up that area too much because you could very easily be framed on some kind of drug charge. Some of the scenery along the way, this scenery is probably typical of most of Thailand. 85% of the population lives in a rural type setting. This is not a living structure. It's a in the hot season it can get up to like 115 degrees Fahrenheit. And the sun is very, very intense. They're only 17 degrees off the equator there. So use that just kind of enclosure in the middle of the day. They'll take a lunch break from about noon to 2 o'clock, and they'll eat lunch and then sleep through the hottest part of the day and then continue working in the afternoon. This is the main highway going from Chiang Mai to Chiang Rai, a little bit different than the United States. That road's only 3 years old, well, 5 years old. It was 3 years old, 2 years ago. Along the way, this is a poinsettia tree, a custom in the United States around the Christmas season to buy poinsettia plants at grocery stores and things and place them in your homes. Well, and Thailand is in a subtropical rainforest type climate, and the poinsettia plant grows as a poinsettia tree. And I saw poinsettia trees that were up to like 40 feet tall, and it looked like it could have, if all leaves and anything fell off, could have been a maple tree for all I knew. This is a small rural village setting, somewhat indicative of the way people live in the Thai countryside. The thatched roofs and just very, very simple living structures. And you can see that, you know, they don't have a big yard or anything. Their crops, the rice crops, the lighter colored green kind of through the center of the picture, is right among their living area. It's more of a cooperative arrangement as far as land usage. Both of these forms of transportation are very commonly seen in Thailand. The front one is, of course, more traditional and of the older style. The family water buffalo that is pulling the cart is a very, very common sight. But then in the background, increasingly, small pickups like Isuzus and Mitsubishis and that type of thing are becoming more and more prevalent as people gain some wealth, sometimes buy a vehicle like that. This is also a rural type of setting, a little more contemporary, a little more polished than the last type of living structure you saw. You can see they have tin on the roofs, and they have the house on the right has concrete columns, and then they use boards for the walls and the floor. It is not uncommon also to see people doing some type of hand labor in the fields, although they do have tractors and will often use the water buffalo as an oxen type of situation. It's not uncommon to see people doing hand labor in the field. About a week after we arrived in Chiang Mai, there's a group of Thai students who, I guess, as we understood, applied to participate in the program, the St. Olaf Chiang Mai University program, and they were kind of like our friends. They befriended us as soon as we entered the city and took us around and kind of showed us the ropes and helped us learn some advanced survival language, like how to order food and the money system, how to barter with merchants and that type of thing. And they put on a traditional dinner called a Kantok dinner. And they took us out and they had us buy, each of the men bought this blue cotton shirt and the women bought a white blouse and some type of print skirt. And then the things around these people's necks are jasmine flowers on strings put together as a necklace. And the tradition is to have the food on a table and you sit cross-legged, Indian style, you might say, and then you eat with your hands, which was an interesting way of eating, although we had already encountered that, so it wasn't quite so off the wall. And the tradition afterwards, the men smoke cigars and the women chew a form of tobacco leaf. I think only two of the women in our group tried that. Most of the men tried a cigar. I'd never smoked a cigar, and I probably never will again. But I had the opportunity to smoke a cigar with the man that I'm smoking it with is kind of one of the top dogs in the university, so to speak. He was involved in our program and was one of our teachers. About half of the weekends that we were there, we would go on some type of excursion out of the city to someplace else, some type of cultural experience. In this situation, we went to a rural village for a weekend, I think 4 days and three nights, and paired off the Thai students and the American students one-on-one, and then each went and stayed with a family in the rural village. Now you have to understand, this is, and we took Land Rovers to get here, this is really I mean, it's kind of like Colton Village. It's really far out in the middle of nowhere. Except we have electricity and running water, and they didn't. I ended up staying with the head villager, and Thai would be Pai Mu Ban, and this is the home that I stayed in. And this is pretty nice. This is probably one of the nicest buildings in the village. And they weren't necessarily poor or destitute. It's just they have a different way of life than we do. I mean, they were well fed, and they seemed to be happy people for the most part. But if, you know, if we had to live in a structure like this for a long period of time, we may become uncomfortable with that. But their way of life is much different than ours. It's based on an agricultural subsistence type of economy, where they don't have to make a lot of money to buy lots of things, because they really did get two trucks out for like 300 or 400 people, and that was to make supply runs to the city.
Jeff?
Yeah?
Was that a dog in the front or a monkey?
That's a Thai version of the canine animal. dogs in Thailand are quite crude and gross, and if we saw them, we would say they're mutt to the 10th power. When we first entered the country, we were told by the U.S. Embassy to not pet any of the dogs roaming the street. They had taken a random sample a couple years before of the dogs, street dogs in Bangkok, and 40% were rabid. So a couple of people in our group happened to pet a dog that looked a little more like an American dog and thought it was cute, and they had to go get rabies shots just to be on the safe side. And anybody that knows anything about rabies shots know that they are given through the stomach, or the old way, at least. And it's very, very painful, and it's like there's 8 or 9 shots or something like that. So you just stay away from them. You know, and they come at you, you just kick at them and throw rocks at them. This is the village water well, which happened to be in the backyard of the house that I stayed in. And everybody came and drew their water from here. And we helped with the chores. We'd go out every day and help draw water and help clean up and this kind of thing. This is a mortar and pestle? This is a larger version in the Thai country. And they use this for grinding grains, specifically rice. And the long, vertical piece goes down into a, it's like a large gourd or large bowl. The horizontal piece goes back and is attached to another horizontal piece on an axis, and then a person stands on the end of it and hangs onto handrails, and then they can balance their weight to lift that and drop that into the bowl structure to grind the grain. This is looking out kind of opposite side of the yard from that mortar and pestle. The little wooden structure kind of on the right center there is the latrine, and it's a gravity type toilet. It's a squat toilet, and the red urn is full of water, and it has a little cup, and after you use the facility, you scoop water, pour it into the toilet, and then by gravity it'll force the sewage down through a trap and then down into the ground. So it's, for as crude it was quite, you know, semi-sanitary compared to a lot of the other types of sanitation we saw. Then the structure on the left is a splash bath shower. They just have a big barrel of water and a big cup, and you just you wet yourself and then soap up and then rinse yourself off. Cold water. Inside the home, you can see that, you know, they have some kind of linoleum, and they have some type of wall board. I don't know if you can see the window in the background. To the left of it is something on a table covered by cloth. Well, that's a TV. And then on the floor to the right of the window is a 12-volt car battery. And we were there over the weekend. All the men gathered and turned it on and watched Thai boxing all Saturday afternoon. And things like TVs and batteries and things like that are starting to work their way out of the city and into the, more into the countryside.
Whose picture was on the calendar? Right.
That's the king.
Oh.
Yeah, they have a monarchy. And the king really doesn't, politically he doesn't hold much clout. The parliament, I think it's parliament, makes most of their political decisions, laws, that type of thing. But the king is kind of in charge of cultural and social type advancement in the country. And he's a, for a king, he's quite young. I think he was only 50. And he was a very charismatic figure. I mean, everybody really loved the king and the queen. And they would travel around, and like when they had the floods in Bangkok, he would be out on the streets talking to people and consoling them. And kind of like Ronald Reagan does on TV, but not quite as tacky. This is the cooking area, which is in the back side of the house. The woman standing here is a servant. Many young women from, say, the ages of 18 to 23 or 24 will serve as servants to somebody else for a while until they become married or maybe go to some type of school and get a job. They have a, it burned a, some, I don't think it was coal, it was some type of fuel, but it wasn't wood. And that's how they cook all their meals. The meals are quite simple. We had, each day we'd have the same thing three times a day. And it was basically rice with, and then we'd have some type of vegetable, sometimes with meat mixture. And basically just the two different types of food. It's very common for Thai people to get posters of, say, movie stars and popular people in the country and put them up on the wall. And also some of the pictures on top are maybe of relatives who have become important in their area of work or something like that. This small shrine is very common. They have, you can see they have a Buddha figure in the lotus position with glasses, no less. And then the other ornamental structure on the left, not the flowers, but the gold colored one, was something to do with ancestral worship, and I never could figure out exactly what the relation was between the Buddhist religion and the ancestral worship and other type of spirit worship that the village people had in the rural areas. It was a quite an odd combination, and we never really did learn exactly what that was. This is garlic that they have hanging from the ceiling to dry. It looks like the whole village root cellar.
Jeff, did you ever show Tosh that?
What? I don't know, I should probably send him a 8x10 or something. While staying in the village, I got to do my first and so far only hike in an actual jungle. And this is a pretty open area compared to the stuff we were climbing through. Didn't see any snakes though. I don't like snakes. This is the Thai village equivalent of our D6 or D4 cat. They don't have snow, so they don't have to put a blade on it. But really, they use this animal for clearing land. Is primarily what it's used for. Type of agriculture in Thailand is very similar to what Tim Meinzen talked about in Sierra Leone. It's a slash and burn type of agriculture. The soil itself really isn't fertile enough to farm on or to do agriculture on for much more than 2 or 3 years. So after they exhaust the soil in one area, they'll cut down and burn timber and brush on another section of land and then farm there for a while and then keep moving on. And I got to ride the elephant. One of the, when we took our Christmas vacation, my friend Ruben and I traveled together. We took a train down to Malaysia and went and sat on a beach and stayed at a nice hotel. And this is on the train. We paid for a 27-hour train ride from Bangkok, Thailand into Malaysia for a second-class berth, which with clean sheets and everything, we paid $20. Three women from our group traveled to the same area, and then we split up there. And this is how we spent a lot of our time when we were being transported, just reading books or listening to music or sitting around. But you can read the English version is the second one from the top. This was at the Malaysia, as we went into the Malaysian border. And we're staying there, and I don't know if this was fate or what, but a West German man came up and asked us if he could put some boxes with our luggage. And we were kind of a little bit suspicious, so we asked him, well, why? And he told us he was smuggling arms into Malaysia. We didn't want him to, the authorities to see him with so much luggage and search it. And we're just like, go away, please don't come near me. We decided we were going to go for the tourist version of Malaysia for a few days. We stayed in this hotel, really quite a nice hotel, air conditioning, hot showers, really nice beds, right on the ocean. Paid $30 a night, $15 per person. This is the view we have from our window. We had a swimming pool. There are some ultra first class international hotels down the beach from us. Holiday Inn, that even in Malaysia was costing like $150 a night. But that was like, as soon as you walked into the property, they had bellboys and such carrying your luggage around. So it was very, very first class. This is like a little veranda underneath the palm trees. You sit on the, we'd usually just run around. It's on an island just off of Malaysia, but it's still considered part of Malaysia. And we would wander around the island, take buses around, and just look at things. Then come back to this area in the late afternoon and sit and read or write letters or just sit. And every evening we sat there, we had a warm breeze come off the ocean. So we just sat there and we're happy to be alive. It was really a really nice situation. And watch the sun go down and then go out there. And we're on a fairly low budget. So we had one nice meal a day. We would eat dinner. We'd have a nice dinner, which you could get crab or lobster or something and you'd pay $4 or $5. And this was fresh daily. So we really weren't splurging all that much. Then after that, we got a real cheap flight just on a very spontaneous decision. Went to southern Thailand to another island and stayed on another set of beaches. And we rented a Jeep the day we got in and drove around until we found a really deserted beach. And we found this little place called Friendship Bungalow. I don't know if you can see the sign back there. And we got this one little end room, and it was just a little double bed, and it did have a shower, although it was cold and had a fan, and we paid $2 a night. And this is the beach that we see. We could go sit on the beach, or we did some snorkeling here too. My friend Ruben has snorkeled in the Caribbean. He said this far out did the Caribbean, and I don't know if you've seen the Jacques Cousteau movies and pictures and that, and really brilliant colored fish and that type of thing. Well, you know, I actually saw the, like real, real bright yellow fish and really, real bright green and blue. It was really astounding. I saw moray eel. In fact, it almost bit my friend Ruben. But we could sit on the beach for say 2 hours at a time, and nobody would walk by us. There was only that one set of bungalows on the whole beach. The Jeep we were in. Again, it was only like $10 a day to drive it all over the place. Mm. And this is the set of bungalows we stayed at. We finally figured out that it must have been some kind of a supply center for ocean travelers, world travelers that travel around sailboats. So sailboats would come in and anchor for a couple days, come in on their little rubber rafts and get cases of water and food and beer and whatever they wanted for their trip, and then go back out there. And then they leave a couple days later.
Was the petrol expensive?
Pardon?
Was the gasoline expensive?
Compared to the U.S. it was. What we figured out was ranging from $2.50 to $3 a gallon if we were to buy it in the States for the same type of pricing they had it there. Another one of our weekend excursions was to go to two ancient civilizations, the first two primary civilizations in Thailand. One is called Sukhothai, the other one is called Ayutthaya. Then the pictures, the next 10 or 12 pictures, is just a mixture of the two of those. The Sukhothai civilization was thriving 700 to 800 years ago, actually preceded Bangkok. And all the ruins that have been excavated here have been done in the past 7 or 8 years, and been done primarily with funding from UNESCO. I don't know if everybody's familiar with United Nations Education, something, something, something. It's the organization that it's put on through the UN. It's the organization that the Reagan administration has cut off funding to, I think just like a year and a half or 2 years ago. And that may not seem that big a deal, but the U.S. was providing 45% of the funding. So projects like this, excavating these kind of ruins, are the kind of projects that go on the standstill when we withdraw aid from those type of organizations. And you have to remember, these brick structures here are 700 to 800 years old, and they've been excavated out, and they were covered with earth and all sorts of things. The bricks here are laterite brick. The soil here, I think it had a high iron content. They would cut out blocks, set them in the sun to bake, and then use them to build with. So this isn't even actually rock, it's just evolved into a type of rock over time. Tim Meinzen talked about this type of brick being used in Sierra Leone also for building structures. The columns in the foreground, it is theorized that used to be some type of hall to gather in, and they think that the walls and the roof of the structure were made out of wood, and just the columns and the foundation is what remains after so many years, and the wood obviously deteriorated. Again, you have another Buddha structure, which is radically different from the previous ones. The way the body's positioned, the facial features, the type of ornamentation on the head.
Any idea what happened to this civilization?
Pardon?
Any idea what happened to this civilization?
It declined. I don't remember exactly. Part of the religion course that we had, Buddhist religion, involved going to a wat, W-A-T, which is a Buddhist monastery. And we stayed at this wat for a week and had some instruction from a Buddhist monk in meditation and yoga. So a Buddhist monk liked to get up at 6 in the morning when it was still dark and cold out and get us up to do yoga exercises. And I'm not adverse against practicing yoga. I think it's interesting, but at 6 in the morning when it's still 35 or 40 degrees outside, and they don't have heating in the buildings. This is just in one of the yards, different heads of different Buddha images. This Buddhist image comes from a time when the Buddha was trying to reach nirvana or enlightenment. And he thought at that time that self-denial of physical desires was one of, or he was trying that out as one of the ways to attain enlightenment. So he basically starved himself. And this image portrays the Buddha when he was going through that phase. They had an underground system of caverns and tunnels in this monastery. You could never figure out, they had some very bizarre and interesting artifacts and things underground, but we weren't quite sure what it was for them. We were practicing different type of stretching. The emphasis on the yoga and the meditation was to divorce your mind from your body, to be able to concentrate on your mind or your spirit, I guess I should say. And through relaxation of the muscles, through exercise, you can concentrate on the spirit. And we went, did different types of breathing exercises, the real popular idea, the and the humming and that type of sitting and that type of thing. And this was another thing that he taught us, out of the three-point headstand, which I finally figured out how to do, but I couldn't do it very long. But our instructor could remain in this position for remain in the position for 20 minutes once. He kept saying that if you concentrate, you can perform things that the normal person cannot perform without being a super bodybuilder or gymnast or something. And I was dubious at first, but then when he was able to do it, I was a little bit astounded. He could also remain, I can't get my legs in that position either. My legs don't work that way. But when he was practicing, trying to teach us how to breathe, he would, concentration was on the exhale and the inhale. And he would exhale and or inhale for like a minute. He would exhale and then inhale for a minute and then exhale. And I couldn't figure out where he was putting the air. Near the end of the trip, my friend Ruben and another woman, Emily, and I, we had met two Peace Corps workers who lived near this is a refugee camp near the border of Laos in eastern Thailand. And through these Peace Corps workers, we were able to get directions to the house, which was near here, and then directions up to the refugee camp. We were able to visit it one weekend, following slides or from there. Now, if you look out over the refugee camp, we estimated that the total acreage was about 75 acres, and current estimates of the population at the time we were there were 40,000 members. So I don't know the exact numbers, but that's a pretty high population density. Quarters are really close. I mean, these little thatched huts are 10 to 12 people, extended family, aunts, uncles, friends, that type of thing, living in each of these structures. For the most part, the people seemed well-fed. You didn't see anybody look like they were starving. They seemed to have clothing, all that wasn't and all the latest styles like, say, we might have. But they did seem to have adequate clothing. Seemed to be somewhat happy, regardless of their situation. I mean, you're able to see people, playing and goofing around, laughing and that type of thing. It is fairly primitive. They don't have a sewage system. This is just an open sewer ditch, and they make use of all available space, so they build living structures right over the open sewers. So the potential for disease is quite prevalent. Again, it's real tight quarters. These people they're Hmong refugees from the hills of Laos. And I don't know if anybody knows the historical conflict in Laos, but in 1975, the quote-unquote communist faction won power and took over the political system. Now, the Hmong refugees were sympathetic with the CIA throughout the Vietnam conflict, and the Laotian conflict was happening at the same time as the Vietnam conflict. So when the communist faction took over, these people was basically to hang around and get killed or get the heck out of there. So they fled into Thailand, but the Thai government doesn't want... They all look the same to us, they all seem the same to us, but they have some very fine cultural and ethnic lines, which we don't really know anything about. And they didn't want these people integrated into their society for their own various reasons. So they put them in refugee camps. The same thing happens with the people from Cambodia. But the Vietnamese are still desecrating the country of Cambodia, so people continue to flow into Thailand from Cambodia. Of course, Coca-Cola is there. They're also in mainland China. They're everywhere we went. This is part of the village water system. As crude as it looks, it was seemed to be, just by looking around, seemed to be fairly sanitary. I mean, I think if I would have drank that water, I would have got sick, just because I'm not used to the bacteria and organisms that is in the water. But the people there are used to them, and so can drink the water with not much problem. The way the camp keeps going is that different organizations like World Vision, Christian Aid International, and other secular and religious aid organizations come and set up health centers and cultural centers and what have you to try and help the people along, give them some basic medication, that type of thing. Traditionally, the women, the Hmong women, do a lot of handwork, craft work. Now these blankets or quilts, you know, they're all hand done, and we could have bought one there. I bought some small things. I didn't have enough money to buy a large blanket. These would cost about $50 there, about $350 in Bangkok, and probably $500 or $600 in the States.
Mm. Are they pieced quilts, or are they embroidered or woven, or
embroidered by hand? This woman got really excited when I wanted to take a picture of her daughter. Something that Richard the cook from Minneapolis has just told me is this camp is named Bon Vinai, and its relationship to where I come from in Minneapolis, I found out when I came back, is a little bit coincidental. Minneapolis has a large Hmong population, and at least 50% or more come from this refugee camp. And when I got back in Minneapolis and started talking with people, I met people who worked with these refugees in Minneapolis, helping them settle, learn our society, that type of thing. Anyways, Richard told me that he had heard that this camp had been bombed in the not too distant past, bombed or raided or something like that. Talked with this man, he knew English, and we asked him where he's from, trying to see if he would tell us where in Laos, and he told us Bon Vinai, which is the name of the camp. So essentially, he'd been there for 4 years. Essentially, they don't consider Laos their home anymore because they can't go back there. Because if he went back, he would be killed. He's waiting, he knows English quite well, and works with like the World Vision Health Centers and was awaiting resettlement. Probably within the next 6 months after we had been there. This is the gate leaving the refugee camp. It's like common to most of the refugees, but the kicker is, well, they can go beyond the gate, but they can't travel very far, because if they get stopped and don't have a Thai citizenship card, then they'll get arrested and sent to prison. So all Thai citizens carry citizenship cards, and that's the way they control the refugees, so that they don't, you know, break out and run all over the country. But you know, they really can't go much beyond this gate, whereas we can walk away, get on the bus, the truck, whatever, go back to Chiang Mai, finish our studies, and come back to the United States. So while they were fed and some of the basic needs were being met, the people here were they're all there on an indefinite basis. They don't know how long they'll be there.
Did he resent you?
Well, the one man I talked to that spoke English was really, really excited to talk to us. But a lot of the people just, we couldn't talk to them that well because it's a different dialect. But they, you could tell just by their actions. Like if you try and take a picture, they kind of shy away or they kind of give you a scowl or something. Some people resented us. Some people welcomed us and would parade their children together to take pictures or something like that. So it was kind of mixed.
What do they have to do to get resettled in the United States? Do they have to be sponsored by somebody like World Vision in order to do that?
Not necessarily. I think if you're a refugee in the camp, well, first thing you want to do is start learning English. Start helping out with the aid organizations. Mm-hmm. Get to know Westerners who have contacts who can help you get out. Apply. Keep applying. Fill out application after application. Something that's happened over the past 3 or 4 years that not many people are aware of is the United States has cut the quotas that are allowed of refugees that are allowed to resettle in the United States down dramatically, like by half over a period of 3 or 4 years. It kind of runs with the whole illegal alien type of issue with people coming from Mexico and that. I don't know that much about it, but I just know that those quotas have been cut back.
Is there any other place that they can go other than here?
Yeah, they're resettled, quite a few resettled in Europe and some in Australia. Next pictures will be mostly up in the city of Chiang Mai, where I lived for 3 years, or 3 months. This is the family I stayed with. The father was, we got placed in families that, I guess, you compared to America, say middle class. And the father was a forester. He was head forester for Chiang Mai province, essentially the northern third of the country. A fairly responsible and important position. And his wife was a professor at the university in agriculture. And she, during college, I worked for the USDA in Minneapolis for the summers. Quite coincidentally, she had a grant from the USDA to do seed technology research to produce more hardy strains of seeds of legal cash crops for village or hill tribe people, so that they quit growing opium. That's one of the ways that the United States is trying to deal with that problem, with the drug problem of growing opium and having that transported through the Southeast Asian countries back into the States. This went to the root of the problem. If they can get them to grow things that will be economically feasible instead of opium, then you can cut down a lot of the opium trafficking. The three little kids. Kind of the smallest, the youngest daughter on the upper right, and I got to be really good buddies. We grew really good, not very much, but we had a lot of fun playing together. This is the home I lived in. Need some explanation. The brown second story structure is where the family lived. Below that is a barber shop that they owned. They didn't work at it, they just owned it and hired people. To the right, behind that white grating is a, it's called a guest house. It's kind of like a little boarding house. I had a room up in there. And on the ground floor below that is a typing service that they own. Students will come in and pay a little bit of money to be able to use a typewriter and type their papers then. In addition to the two career jobs and all this, the Thai mother owned a dormitory at the university. They were privately owned, and then the students would pay the owners, the rent. So they had their fingers in just about everything you could think of as far as money goes. This is the kitchen. Refrigerator in Thailand is a status symbol. They used it some, but essentially bought all of their food daily at the market. Once in a while we'd have chicken every 3 days or so, mostly rice, fish, lots of vegetables. The two most used utensils is the stove, and then that looks like a crock pot, it's a rice cooker. This is where the family lives. It's quite small. I have this room and then the next room, a room this size to the right, which is split into two bedrooms, one for the parents, one for the children. But although it's not real large, you can see they have some of the necessary 1980 status symbols. They have a little electric organ in the front there with the cover on it, stereo behind that, color TV, VCR. This here is the kind of their shrine or whatever. Most type homes have some type of shelf like this with things. Now you notice the importance of the Buddhist image behind the golf trophies there. Kind of what I decided, or what we figured out about Thai families, they have the equivalent of Sunday Christians, maybe kind of Sunday Buddhist people that say go to church on Sunday because it's kind of something you do as an American commitment, but aren't necessarily sincere or serious about any type of religious faith. These people were good people by most accounts, but they weren't real devout or serious Buddhist people. This is the building on the left, and then on the right there, two buildings we spent most of our time in at the university. We studied through the division called Faculty of Humanities, housed religion, languages, history, philosophy, that type of thing. And sometimes this class is a little bit hard to pay attention to because the weather was quite nice most of the time. We were there during not the dry season, which becomes very, very hot and very, very dry. But I think they turned it winter, I think. But the winter ended about the middle of February and then the dry season started. This is Chiang Mai, city of about 100,000, second largest city in Thailand, from second to Bangkok. After Chiang Mai and Bangkok, there's really no city of major consequence. There are some population centers, but nothing nearly as large as Chiang Mai or Bangkok. This is a little shopping area called the Night Bazaar, or in Thai, Night Bazaar. A lot of the village people from the country and the hill tribes would come in with their craft work and handiwork and sell, kind of rent little stalls in here and sell their goods. That's where I bought this shirt I'm wearing. This is the shirt I wore to the traditional Thai dinner when we first got there. This is called the Chiang Mai Tea House. See, in English, homemade cooking, steak, pizza, yogurt, da-da-da-da. It was kind of a fun place to go because you could go and just sit quietly and have something to eat. And they did pretty good with Western food if we were getting sick of eating ethnic food. But the fun thing is they had kind of folk singers and musicians would come in. And they're all Thai musicians, but they'd sing in English and they'd sing Cat Stevens and Simon Garfunkel and Carla Bonoff and Ricky Lee Jones. And like all music I listened to, so I used to go hang out there sometimes. This is just a little restaurant across the street from my house. Some of us that lived in the city, we were kind of scattered all over the city, but those of us who lived in the core would sometimes get together and go here and have something to eat, have something to drink, and we got to know the shopkeeper quite well. He'd see us coming, hey, come on in. He knew a little bit of English and he'd yell at us. They have a lot of these small restaurants or small eating establishments right on the street. Go in, food's quite cheap. It's a very good place to travel if you want to travel in the East or overseas at all, because transportation is cheap, food is, you can go in and get a plate of fried rice with some type of vegetable and some type of meat, chicken or shrimp or whatever in it, or maybe an egg in it for like 50 or 60 cents. And they'll give you bottled water if they see that you're Western, because they know that you can't drink tap water very well, you might get sick. So this is fairly common. Most men, well, all males in the Thai society are expected to serve as a Buddhist monk for at least about a 3-month period at one point in their lives. A lot of them do it when they're younger. Some decide to stay with it. We'll do it for several years. Some do it for life, obviously. But they don't make any income at all. And a common practice in the early morning is for people to come out with food, bowls of rice, vegetables, whatever, and the monks will line up and they'll feed the monks. It's an understanding in their society that they're serving their society by being monks, and so the people feel an obligation to help them out as they're serving. It's a quite a cooperative arrangement. There's nothing organized, it just happens. A lot of little trinket stands. Chiang Mai is a fairly touristy city. A fair amount of Americans, but mostly European and Australians travel up there. And you have all these little trinket things, and people are always tugging on your shoulder trying to get you to buy something. Fairly common market scene. All along the right sidewalk down there on the lower right side is vegetable and garment shops. And you can go and they just line up one after another, and it was really fun to go walk by there, just because you saw Thailand right there. You saw so much of Thailand in one little space. Transportation, this is called a sila. Si or si in Thai is the number 4. La is refers to some mode of transportation, some type of vehicle. 4 wheels, it's a transportation vehicle, sila. I could ride this from my home in the middle of the city to the university on the outskirts for about 10 cents, about 2 miles, I think about half an hour through the city. They also have these called samlas. Sam is the number 3. Saw these mostly in Bangkok. These are a little more expensive because it's a bigger city. They also drive like maniacs who try to avoid these. The driving in Southeast Asia is just a zoo. I mean, I'm standing here trying to get across the road, and there's a steady stream of traffic. And we finally learned after a few days that to get across the road, you have to step out in front of cars, and they will slow down. And we never got hit, but I mean, it was rather unnerving because you actually had to step out in front of people to get across. Otherwise, you'd stand there for 20 minutes. This is another form of samla. These people who drive these little three-wheeled bicycle things around, they're kind of on the lower end of the status scale. Thai society is quite a hierarchical society. Being an American, I automatically had money, which put me on a fairly high status level. Two, I was there for educational purposes. That education is another status symbol. And then age is the third major criteria for determining status. Now this man probably is not educated, probably doesn't make a whole lot of money, isn't that old, and he doesn't have much status. He's one of the lower status people in the society. Some of our professors had a fair amount of status because they always had money endeavors on the outside to make money. We're of mid-age, 30s to 40s. And were involved in education, so they had a lot of status. And then the older people in society, senior citizens, had quite a bit of status. They don't get the neglect that some of the senior citizens do in our country. Some pictures of some of the people that were in our program, the Sinhala students. We went on a houseboat ride. The man in the foreground, his name is John. He looks very Chinese, and a lot of Thai people have Chinese origins. Their cultural background comes from China, or not all of them, but a lot of them. New Year's Eve. My friend Ruben kind of fell in love with a Thai woman who was attending St. Olaf when we got back, and after he graduated, he worked for a while, got enough money to go back over, and went back over and is living in Thailand right now. He's working for an American agency called the Consortium, and he's involved in the final stages of mainlining and teaching refugees from camps like we visited American societal skills, money, language, what a doctor is, dentist, you know, those kind of things. In the last stages of people being mainlined into an American culture. Kim, the woman on the right, is of Vietnamese origin. She attended Augsburg in Minneapolis, went on our program. She grew up, or excuse me, Korean background. And she grew up in South Korea and moved to the States, was adopted, I guess, when she was 8 years old. Christmas, even that Christmas tree. We had a turkey dinner. Halloween. We had one final dinner before we left, a kind of big banquet. So we're on our houseboat trip, we spent the night on a big floating raft. And the interesting thing is, Americans all take their clothes off in their bathing suits and try and get a tan. Well, the Thai people don't try and get a tan because the darker you are means the more you've worked outside in the fields, which means you're a peasant, which means you have lower status. So we're out there taking our clothes off, and they're putting up umbrellas and putting blankets over their heads. It was kind of funny.